Well, it's been another long week. We talked about the pros and cons of casino gambling in Georgia. We evaluated whether journalists still have an obligation to be objective. And we discussed the role that athletes play when they take on social activism. So, as we do every Friday, we've gathered a group of very smart people to help us kick back, unwind, and think back about what the heck happened this week. It's time for the break room.
Everyone knows, of course, Hillary's belief that it takes a village, which only makes sense, after all, in places like Haiti, where she's taken a number of them.
Gee, Bert, you'd rather read some book than play ball?
It's not just some book, Ernie. It's a really good book, and I want to finish it.
We love our chicken wings. It's like my favorite thing to eat. Every time I eat them, I get the sauce all over my face, all over my hands. I need like a million napkins because it's so messy.
Hey, who doesn't? Joining us in the break room are Roxanne Donovan. She's the assistant chair of the Interdisciplinary Studies Department and a professor of psychology and interdisciplinary studies at Kennesaw State University. Welcome, Roxanne.
Morning.
Hector Fernandez directs the Center for Latin American and Latino Studies at Georgia State University. Hi, Hector.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm doing all right. With me here in GPB's Macon studio is Charles Richardson. He is the editorial page editor for the Telegraph newspaper in Macon. Welcome back, Charles.
Good morning, everybody.
I should probably turn on your mic for you there.
Good morning, everybody.
There we go.
Yeah.
And making her break room debut is Julianne Thompson. She's a former press secretary for the Georgia Republican Party. Hey, welcome, Julianne.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you via the Skypes there. Now let's say, folks, it's not an exaggeration to say that the 2016 campaign has been pretty vicious, and things got even uglier last night at the Al Smith Dinner. This is an event to raise money for Catholic charities in New York City, and it has historically been sort of a lighthearted night where both candidates roast each other, but gently, kind of retirement party jokes, more so than like Comedy Central roast type jokes. But by the end of Donald Trump's remarks, he was being repeatedly booed by the audience. Let's listen.
Hillary believes that it's vital to deceive the people by having one public policy and a totally different policy in private. That's okay. I don't know who they're angry at, Hillary. You're right. For example, here she is tonight in public pretending not to hate Catholics.
Yeah. So Hillary got in some zingers as well. And the last 18 months or so have been enough to make just about everybody ready for this election to be over. This week, the American Psychological Association said a survey showed more than half of Americans are stressed about the election. The psychology experts published a list of tips for how to deal with the next few weeks. Folks, are you feeling stressed? How do you cope? Do you stop reading the news? And Roxanne, you feeling stressed about the election?
Oh, I'm in the half that's stressed for sure. In fact, at the debate, 45 minutes in, I had to just get up and walk away because I was holding tension in my body. It was really, really bad. So
yeah.
What do
How
I
about
do?
You, Hector? What do you do? Yeah, what do you do?
I don't read the comments when I read the news.
Don't read the comments.
And I take social
Never
media
read the
breaks.
Comments.
Oh, I try not to. Sometimes I get sucked in, but I really, really try not to.
Well, Hector, how you feeling? How's your self-care?
No, I'm not stressed. I'm exhausted. You know, every now and then I'm dropping the radio station, I'm changing the channel. I'm so turned off by some of the rhetoric. And whenever I see somebody annoying show up, basically, that's it for me. I'm limiting audio and imagery to a minimum. I mostly read the coverage, but hey, I'm not a masochist. So if I find something distasteful, well, I turn it off, basically.
Charles, you're a man with a very calm comportment. Is that deception? Are you dying inside?
Well, I'm with Hector. You know, you reach a certain point where you just don't want to listen to it anymore. And part of my job is to listen to it.
Yeah, that's the thing that stinks, doesn't it? I really wish I could tune out, but I just can't.
So you're sort of drawn to it like a moth is to a flame. And once that wing starts to catch fire and you start to lose altitude, you sort of have to back away. You know, you back away from the cliff. And you start looking at these people in a whole different light. Like, did you really say something that stupid? You know, Do you really believe this? And then you realize that even they're smiling. They say, this is the act I've got to put on. And they're smiling. And I remember I was watching, I think, Anderson Cooper, and he's got this grin on his face like, you just said that? Are you kidding me? So, you know, you take it with a lot of salt, and you just make sure you have no shoes when you're watching on your couch, because you just might throw one through your TV.
Julianne Thompson, I imagine that this election season is different for you psychologically, being someone who used to work at a very high level with the state Republican Party. You have a personal stake in this.
Yes, and I was also assistant press secretary in the U.S. House of Representatives Judiciary Committee. So the way that public image has always been extremely important to me. As far as the Al Smith dinner last night, it was funny to a certain respect. I think the first part of Donald Trump's remarks were funny, and then it kind of went downhill from there. Certainly with this election, you know, I couldn't have called it the way that it went. You asked me a year ago, I would have said Donald Trump will be out of this race within 30 days. And he made a lot of what I considered to be gaffes and got bumps in the polls right afterwards. So you can't really call the way this election is going, but it certainly has been a stressful one.
I bet. I just bet. Now, speaking of the campaign, folks, Donald Trump invited President Obama's estranged half-brother to the final presidential debate Wednesday night. Malik Obama lives in Kenya and supports Trump. Also on the Trump guest list was a woman whose son was killed in the 2012 attack on the American consulate in Benghazi, Libya. Meanwhile, Hillary Clinton brought high-profile GOP defector Meg Whitman, who ran unsuccessfully for governor of California, also billionaire Mark Cuban, who has made no secret of his negative feelings about Trump in public remarks. Guys, what do you think about this tactic of inviting your opponents, your opponents' enemies, maybe too strong a word to use, but your opponents' opponents to the debates to maybe psych them out? Roxanne, what do you think?
I can't believe this is happening. It's almost surreal. I just wish they would stop playing these middle school mind games and work harder to challenge each other with actual data, facts, explanations, policies, you know. They're trying to psych each other out, but I can't imagine that it's working, and it's a lot of time and energy. Hey, invite me to the debate. I actually want to be there, and, well, no, maybe I don't. Never mind. Go on.
Go ahead, actor.
Listen, if you want to make a valid policy case, like in the State of the Union, then I see it happening. But if it's just
you mean like bringing someone to be an example of
exactly,
a point that you
exactly,
want to illustrate?
Exactly.
Right?
That should make it valid. But if the whole point is to annoy your rival or just to get under their skin, there's only a word for that. That's juvenile. For Christ's sake, this is a presidential race. We're talking about the United States of America here.
Well, Hector, remember, this entire race has been juvenile. So,
but hold on. You know, gamesmanship is nothing new to politics.
Nothing new, but nobody knows whether Hillary Clinton even knows what Barack Obama's brother looks like.
Good point.
Yeah, well.
You know, so, you know, did he make a cameo appearance? Did they have a press conference with him before the debate? I mean, are you supposed to be, ooh, there's Barack Obama's brother. Whoa. You know, or Mark Cuban. I mean, who's he supposed to scare? You know, if he brought a couple of his basketball players there that are 7 foot tall, that might make an appearance, but my goodness, it is. It's just, if you are on that stage, there's enough stuff to take you off your game other than Meg Whitman.
Julianne Thompson, what do you make of it as a tactic?
Well, I agree with everything that everybody has said so far. I think it's juvenile, and I certainly wouldn't have advised, at least on the Republican side, for Trump to do that. But let's face it, this has become a reality TV election, and there are no innocent parties here. There are no angels in this presidential election. Both sides are guilty of doing the same exact thing. So I agree with what everybody else said.
Whoa. We're going to compare apples with oranges there. I mean,
that's a false equivalency.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
when it comes to intimidation tactics at debates, that's what we're talking about.
We're talking about, you know, the general show. I mean, if you describe it as a reality show election, you know, definitely you have to score somebody higher, way higher.
Well, the question was, how did I feel about the intimidation tactics at the debates? And that's what I'm referring to, and that's what I answered.
All right. As long as we clarify that it hasn't been the same thing and the same show on both sides, right?
Okay, well, we'll go ahead and leave that there, and let's talk about something really important, which is that apparently eating chicken wings with a man is a problem for some women. There's all sorts of advice online claiming to have the best way to eat them. Some are how-to videos. Let's listen to a woman from Buffalo asking comedian and talk show host Steve Harvey for help with this particular crucial dilemma.
I'm a single girl. I go on a lot of dates. I always go out to eat, and I always order my wings. My problem is these guys are looking at me like they're disgusted. So I need you to show me a more ladylike way to enjoy my buffalo wings without being so messy.
Okay, so a new and quite expensive club has opened in New York City. It's for women only, giving them a place to eat chicken wings in peace without judging men around. The price tag is between $1,500 and $2,000 a year. Julianne, I'll start with you. Are women really this worried about what men think about their gustatory habits when it comes to the wings of certain fowl?
You know, I don't even know how to answer that. I really don't. This is such an irrelevant topic.
Sorry, boss. Just trying to have a little fun on a Friday.
I know. But I
guess what do you call it?
It is fun in light of this entire election that we've had to deal with. But I doubt it. I don't think it's anything that women are concerned about.
Roxanne, the listeners are dying to know your feelings.
Oh, I'm eating wings like it's going out of style, and I don't care who's watching. But I really had to figure out what was behind this wing place. So I went to the website, and what I realized, at least in how they describe it, is that they conceptualize the space as woman-only, so women can work and socialize without having to deal with men. So I think the wing is just part of that. That said, almost $2,000 a year to eat lunch, hold my bag, and get my hair blow dried, I'm thinking, no.
It's a corporate thing. It's a corporate thing.
Well, no. You know, men have private clubs all over the place.
Indeed.
So, well, that's exactly the point.
Yeah, so why shouldn't women have their clubs? I mean, where they can sit back in their easy chairs and recliners, smoke cigars, and eat chicken wings.
I think if they advertised it as a socializing space and a space to work, that was more compelling. The wing just seemed a little bit embarrassing.
Wing thing seems
a
hotter mile.
Exactly. Well done, Charles. All right. My guests are Charles Richardson. He's the opinion page editor for the Telegraph newspaper in Macon. Roxanne Donovan is she teaches psychology and does a bunch of other things at Kennesaw State University. Forgive me for just bailing on your official title halfway through that. I work at a university, too, and my title is like half a page. So, all right. Julianne Thompson is a former press secretary for the Georgia Republican Party. She's with us, as is Hector Fernandez, director of the Center for Latin American and Latino Studies at Georgia State University. And we want to thank Savannah Coffee Roasters for donating the coffee that is fueling our break room guests this morning. They are online at savannahcoffee.com. Let's talk about something a little bit weightier than chicken wings, which is where I can't believe we left things before the break. But public complaints about police officers dropped by 93%. When those officers were wearing body cameras. That is according to researchers at the University of Cambridge in Britain. They studied two police departments in Southern California and four in the UK. This would seem to be some proof that body cameras have a beneficial effect. Charles, does this research surprise you?
Not at all. I would like to see them probably expand their research to places like Chicago, New York, some larger urban areas than the cities that they chose. But I totally understand why they used the cities that they studied. And also in the UK, officers and citizens have a little bit different deployment with each other. But it doesn't surprise me one bit. The cameras seem to sort of make better citizens of everybody.
Yeah, and just to reiterate, what this research indicates is that public complaints about police officers dropping significantly when those officers are wearing body cameras, from which we can probably reasonably conclude that officers were doing fewer things that would provoke public complaints when they were wearing the cameras. Roxanne Donovan, same question to you. Does this research surprise you?
It it surprises me in the amount that it dropped.
93%.
93% is crazy. And in fact, in some areas, it was 0% complaints. And I thought that was amazing. I think it provides considerable support for the use of body cameras. And the interesting part of the research, at least Dr. Barak Ariel's research, is that they found that even when not all police officers were equipped with a body cam, other police officers started acting in ways that were better in their interactions with the public. He called it a contagious accountability. And I think, wow, that's pretty impressive. You're not even wearing it, but watching the other people in blue act in a particular way is helping. So there's a spread effect beyond the cameras. So I'm all for that. I'm all for technological accountability.
Julianne, what do you make of the research?
I think it's wonderful. I agree with what everyone else said. I think that it's a win-win situation. I mean, first of all, as the other panelists said, you have police officers conducting themselves in a manner that they know is going to be viewed by the public, if necessary. But also it protects the police officer as well from false accusations. So I think it's a win-win for both sides.
Hey, one thing, you know what I would love to see? I would love to see the way the data compares, because the Brits have a lot of cameras, and the average British citizen or subject is really used to having cameras all around him or her, whereas in the States we have a fraction of the cameras they have.
Yeah.
So that would be interesting.
Interesting use of the term subject there.
Yeah, well,
you noticed that, Hector.
Yeah.
You are literally correct, yeah.
And Hector, you're right. Cameras do make us nervous.
Right. Let's go ahead and we'll vacillate here between serious things and not serious things. Let's see. Sesame Street is celebrating the 45th anniversary of the book The Monster at the End of This Book.
Oh, hello, everybody. Oh, what is this? The Monster at the End of This Book. Starring lovable, furry, old Grover. Oh, that is me.
Okay, and of course, as people might recall, the premise of the book is that Grover there is terrified that there's apparently going to be a monster at the end of this book. He's very scared of monsters, and then when it gets to the end, oh, the only monster at the end of the book is Grover himself, and there's nothing scary about lovable, furry old Grover. This was one of my colleague Celeste Haley's favorite books as a kid. I've got a two-year-old. I read this book to him once a week, I'd say. But what's kind of struck me as I've been reading him other children's books is how a lot of books that I remember from my youth as being really wonderful are actually really terrible books. guys, like Goodnight Moon is a terrible book. I mean, honestly, the poetry is awful. The illustrations are, the perspective is bizarre. And I can't get behind it. But anyway, so folks, these books, do you like them? Do you have a favorite children's book? Anybody still have kids young enough that you're reading to them?
The Cat in the Hat, which Ted Cruz massacred.
Oh,
there you go.
It's so hard to read, and it goes on and on and on and on.
It's beautiful. It's great.
No, it's a great book, but it's a heavy lift.
I used to read a book, and it's so old. I think it's out of publication, but it was called Snip, Snap, and Snur.
Mm.
And I tried to find it, and it's just. But, you know, I'm 65 years old, so it was a long, long time ago. And my oldest son is 42, so I haven't read, read a book in a long time.
Julianne, what was your favorite kid's book?
Oh, goodness. I don't know. Probably different Dr. Seuss books. I enjoyed them, although my parents hated reading them. But, you know, I just want to say a big congratulations to Sesame Street. They've done an outstanding job there, actually. It's nice that something is actually older than I am. And I grew up on Sesame Street, and, you know, and it's been great to be able to share that with my children as well. My youngest is 11. So I've been able to share some of my childhood memories, relive them with my children. So that's been wonderful.
And I have to say, there is video online of Ted Cruz absolutely killing a reading of Green Eggs and Ham. Honestly, like, nailing it. Roxanne, favorite kids book before we move on?
You know, I didn't grow up in the States, so I didn't have access to Sesame Street. So some of that is not very familiar to me. But I love reading to my kids my boy and girl, 10 and 8-year-old, stories with very strong girl characters, and they're mm-hmm. so hard to find. But my absolute favorite and my kid's favorite is The Paper Bag Princess. And she dumps the guy at the end. Oh, love it. Love everything about it.
Oh, God. Yeah, very
Hector's
good book.
Here just shaking his head.
Not good.
We're talking about the week's news and other things here on The Break Room on GPB's On Second Thought. I'm Adam Ragusea in for Celeste Headlee today. With us, me is Roxanne Donovan, Hector Fernandez, Julianne Thompson, and Charles Richardson. It's been 15 years since singer Mary J. Blige released an album titled No More Drama. You probably remember it.
No more. No more.
Well, one can aspire, but it turns out that Mary J. Blige is still a drama magnet. She and her estranged husband, Kendu Isaacs, both filed for divorce in July amid rumors that he cheated. Isaacs has reportedly demanded nearly $130,000 per month in spousal support, saying that he needs the money for a personal chef, a personal trainer, and $5,000 per month to care for the kids that he has from a previous relationship. Now, granted, his demands would probably strike most people as exorbitant, but I'm wondering if our attitudes on spousal support have changed since the days when it really was created to help women who are abandoned by their husbands. Let's start with you, Roxanne.
I think in the world of the rich and famous, it has definitely changed, but child support is really necessary. I mean, 84% of custodial parents are mothers, 43% received some type of public assistance. So this is about making ends meet at the end of the day. And about 54% of those custodial parents do child support, do not receive it. Or don't receive what they're owed. This is a huge problem, and it's increasing the likelihood for women with children to be in poverty.
Yeah. That said, Hector or Charles, if either of you wants to take this on, absolutely. Men's rights activists, one of the number one things that they like to talk about is alimony reform laws. It can often be the case that even when a man is the lower wage earner, he may still be required in a divorce proceeding to make spousal support payments to his former wife simply because of their respective genders. Do you think that's a legitimate
issue?
That
makes no sense at all. I mean, this should be 50-50. If one of the two parties has a higher income, truly they have to pitch in. And it's basically what stands at the top is the child. That, you know, if the children must, their interest must be the utmost element in whatever solution you have in a divorce. So regardless of the party, any party that has a higher income, they have to pitch in. That's all.
I totally agree with what Westman said. But going to the Mary J. Blige situation, quite frankly, I'd be embarrassed to ask a judge, stand before a judge and say, I want child support for my other baby's children.
But it's amazing how much embarrassment can be assuaged by $150,000 a month.
Yeah, but my personal chef might get insulted. You know, I'm not paying him enough. You know, my personal chef is who I look at in the mirror every day. it hits me wrong.
Okay.
In that particular case. But everything that's been said, it should be 50-50. Yes, Mary J. Blige has a very good income, but this rusty bucket needs to get out and get a job.
Yep, pretty much.
Let's move on to another topic. It's been 30 years since the drinking age was raised to 21. Now experts are releasing some studies that show that there are some negative consequences if parents offer their child even a small taste of alcohol before they reach legal age. Some pieces of research indicating that kids are more likely to drink and even drink heavily later in life if their parents offer them even modest amounts of alcohol when they're young. Some parents feel that it is best that their kids be exposed to alcohol through them. Some parents feel that it's best if their kids and their friends try booze and drink at home where their parents can supervise and make sure that nobody blacks out and dies. Let's listen to an apropos clip.
Is there alcohol in this?
Oh, God, honey, no. What kind of mother do you think I am?
Why, do you want a little bit? Because if you're going to drink, I'd rather you do it in the house.
No, thank you.
Okay. So, guys, what do you think? This is just a perpetual issue, and I while there is some research, it's hardly conclusive. Do you let your kids drink in the house? Do you give them a sip of wine at the table when they're little? What are our thoughts? Julianne, do you want to start?
I certainly don't think you do it when they're little.
Well, 12, 13. I think that's when my dad started giving it to me.
But I have mixed emotions about this. I mean, if you look at Europe, when I was in Italy, there were a lot of kids, 15, 16 years old with their parents drinking a little bit of wine with their dinner, and it didn't seem to cause them to grow up to be alcoholics. However, that getting back to the point about raising the drinking age, here in the United States, that's one I really have mixed emotions about, because at 18 years old, we tell our young men and women that they're old enough to fight and die for this country, but they're not old enough to have a beer. So I really have mixed emotions about it. I think it has to be up to the individual parents.
Do we think that 18 is do we think that from that disparity that Julianne just mentioned, maybe it's that you shouldn't be able to go and fight and die for your country until you're 21? Anybody want to make that argument?
Oh, God.
Limbic system is not fully developed until the age of 25, guys.
Yeah.
You know?
No, well, basically, I don't know if there's ample research on many things, but in terms of, research available out there for the effects, the impact of alcohol before your brain is fully matured.
Yeah.
There is ample research to that. So to that extent, these are parents trying to be cool. These are parents trying to, be friends with the kids. Guess what? That doesn't work very well. These are enablers. And I'm sorry, I do not agree with enabling.
And I think the United States has a huge binge drinking culture that's very unique to our space versus the European space. So I'm about consistency between deed and word. And if I'm saying that drinking to excess is problematic, don't do it, then I need to behave in ways that are consistent. And not only in not giving my children alcohol, but I also need to not imbibe in front of them and show them that this is something that we don't do as a family. And hopefully when I engender those family values, when they go out in the world, they will behave in ways consistent with that.
I've spent a good part of my life on college campuses, and I have seen what overindulgence of alcohol will do. All you have to do is walk through any tailgate. Oh, yeah.
You smelled it, too, I think.
All you have to do is walk through one tailgating party, and you can see exactly what can happen. Yeah. And when you have to write headlines of kids that have decided they were able to drink and drive, and they can handle it, and they don't show up in the next day, it can show you what... And where did all that start? Where did those kegging parties start? Some of them started in the backyard of their parents' house.
Absolutely.
Let's go ahead and just talk very briefly about the news that we started with this show. Greg Bluestein from the AJC was on at the beginning of the show talking about a new AJC poll finding Clinton and Trump in a statistical tie right now in Georgia of all places. So really quickly, folks, what do we think that means? What does that signify? That regardless of the eventual outcome, 3 weeks out from the election, Georgia of all places is in a statistical tie in the presidential race.
First of all, you and Greg also talked about the fact that you had Michelle Nunn showing as a statistical tie as well. And we saw the way that turned out. And then you can also look at the RCP average for the race between Jason Carter and Nathan Deal as being 44% to 48% just a few weeks out, with a margin of error, an average margin of error of about 4%. And we saw the way that turned out. So I don't really think that you can go by polling. They're kind of snapshots in time, as we all know.
Precisely, but what polling tells us is where things are now. It doesn't tell us where it's going to be in 3 weeks, but what does it mean that this is where we are at now, Roxanne?
I think it speaks to the uniqueness of what's happening on the presidential stage right now. What does it mean that Trump isn't getting the majority, the overwhelming majority of the votes, at least beyond the error, in Georgia? And I don't know. I don't know if it means anything. It may mean that we're purple this cycle, but will it impact anything down ballot? I'm thinking not. But I'd be interested to see.
Yeah.
Well, without alluding to any
of
the...
Hector, I'm afraid we got to leave it there. As Trump said, we're going to keep everybody in suspense. Listeners, we'd love to know what you think it means that this is where we're at in the race. 3 weeks to go. This is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Adam Ragusa in for Celeste Headlee. Have yourself a great, great weekend.